Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. On the show ahead, the Booker Prize, the premier award for writing in English, was given this week. We'll speak to one of the judges, and we'll also look back at the extraordinary life of the writer Jan Morris, who's died at the age of 94. We'll hear from our editor, Andrew Tuck, in his weekly column.
I decided it was time to refill the bird feeders and our small rooftop garden. Somehow, a chirped out message along the lines of "the plant-based restaurant that we used to frequent last winter has reopened" had spread around the hood.
Plus, we'll get a full rundown of what's making the papers. All that coming up on Monocle on Saturday. Do stay with us. President Donald Trump's desperate bid to overturn the November the 3rd election result was dealt another blow on Friday after it was announced he'd lost Georgia, and two Republican legislators from Michigan pledged to follow normal process in validating the vote after a White House meeting. Government forces captured two towns from rebel forces in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region, the government said on Friday, and Tigrayan fighters fired rockets at an airport in a neighbouring region. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of people have been killed, and tens of thousands of refugees have already fled from fighting in Tigray, as Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed tries to hold his ethnically diverse nation together. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has warned that the developing world is on the precipice of financial ruin and escalating poverty, hunger and untold suffering as the world struggles to combat the coronavirus pandemic. His message came ahead of a meeting of the leaders of the Group of 20 rich nations and big emerging powers this weekend. And in our weekend edition email bulletin, we admire the Crown's magnificent menswear, find out publishing stalwart Christina O'Neill's weekend reading, and warm up our auction paddles for an enviable collection of mid-century furniture. Head to monocle.com/minute for more. Well, it's time now to have a browse through what else is making the news. And I'm joined on the line by Ruth Michelson, who's a journalist who primarily covers the Middle East and North Africa. Good morning to you, Ruth.
Morning, Georgina.
Now, of course, Donald Trump continues to make headlines, and I suspect will do so for many years still.
Yes, unfortunately, there's still more Trump news. He's still doing it. We still have to cover him until maybe at least January 20th, as you say.
Or possibly another 8 years.
I have to say, I really hope not. I think we all really hope not.
I mean, for the good of the world, yes. But for journalistic excitement, I mean, what will we do when we don't have to wake up in the middle of the night to see what he's tweeted?
I mean, we'll take fewer headache pills, I think. We'll live more relaxed lives.
Tell us what the New York Times is saying about him anyway.
Well, I think the New York Times shares our frustrations, to be perfectly honest. They were talking about his efforts to overturn the election result, and they called it unparalleled in the US. They said that Mr. Trump's chances of succeeding are somewhere between remote and impossible, and that basically what he's doing, the actions that you described at the top of the show, you know, the legal cases, calling in people from Michigan, that this is all just a sign of desperation. And they quote Joe Biden as saying, "I'm confident he knows he hasn't won."
And CNN?
Well, this CNN piece has been getting quite a lot of attention this week. So it looks at this kind of a government bureaucrat that would probably be normally unknown. This is the General Services Administrator Emily Murphy, whose job it is to sign off on the transition, to issue a declaration that means the transition would be officially happening. And she hasn't done it for some reason. She's a Trump appointee, but apparently she is struggling with the weight of the presidential election just being dropped on her shoulders. She feels conflicted. She's thinking about Florida in 2000, but she's also surrounded by people who are saying, "Well, why haven't you issued this letter?"
Very, very difficult position, I understand. Now, the Washington Post is pulling no punches.
Yes, this is, again, another large American broadsheet that I think shares our frustration. They say Trump is using the power of his office to try and subvert the election. They talk about a far-reaching pressure campaign to persuade Republican officials. And they also say that basically, you know, these, what they say is the allegations of widespread voter fraud are obviously baseless. And so now Trump is trying to remain in power by just undermining the integrity of the vote and spreading misinformation, which, of course, is sort of classic Trump tactics.
No, absolutely. And it's not only in the US, of course, that this is making news. Germany's picking up on it, too.
Absolutely. Some analysis in the German weekly broadsheet Die Zeit. They have a piece that is entitled The Downfall Comes with Chaos, which is a rather beautiful way to sum this up, I think. So basically they say that the Trump camp is unwilling to accept the result and is hitting out. They keep talking about the increasingly shrill tone that he's with which he's trying to strike out against the election result.
Now, one person who has spoken out, of course, he has a book to promote, so he's doing a lot of interviews anyway, but it's former President Barack Obama.
Yes. So he's, you know, he's doing his book tour. He's getting a lot of publicity for his record as a statesman, and I suppose Joe Biden kind of by extension. And so this is an interview that he did with the editor-in-chief of El País, the Spanish newspaper, has also been translated into French by Le Figaro, French right-wing newspaper. And, you know, obviously he's asked about the lack of a transition. And he says that he wasn't surprised that this is the way that Donald Trump is acting. And he also, you know, hit out at him in other ways. He said he arranged for all of his agencies and teams to prepare manuals for the transition. That's transition from him to Trump a few years ago. And he said, apparently they weren't always read. One of those manuals was a playbook on how to deal with the possibility of a pandemic. It seems they didn't follow those guidelines that we provided.
Ugh. It would be funny if it wasn't so tragic. Ruth, let's move on to the area that you're primarily concerned with, and that is, of course, the Middle East.
Yes. So the New York Times broke quite a story this week, got a lot of play across the Middle East and beyond. This is the story of the rather cinematic murder of Al-Qaeda's number two. This is a man who goes by the nom de guerre, or did go by the nom de guerre, Abu Muhammad al-Masri. He was apparently killed by two motorcycle riding assassins in August. These were Mossad agents who went to Tehran and assassinated al-Masri, as well as the widow of Osama bin Laden's son, who was also killed, I believe, earlier this year. And the New York Times focused on the fact that the attack was carried out at the behest of the United States. And they then followed up with a second piece looking at reactions from the Iranians, who have been pretty quick to deny the story and likened it to a Hollywood scenario.
And how's the Jerusalem Post covered this?
Well, they picked up a mixture of sort of a Reuters copy that did a rundown of, you know, the story that the New York Times put out, because nobody else could match that story. But they also have talked about how the Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem wouldn't comment on the report, which is pretty standard for the Israelis, who don't like to sort of discuss sources and methods. But they said that basically it has important ramifications, not just for what this means for Al-Qaeda and the senior leadership of Al-Qaeda, but for the region and for US-Israeli cooperation.
And how's it been covered in Saudi Arabia?
So Al Arabiya took, that's the big Saudi channel and website, summarised the report. They looked at the response in Tehran, and then they said, well, it's rather unclear why Iran was giving refuge to al-Masri, why Iranian officials seem to have covered up his death. Iranian officials originally said that he was, I believe, a Lebanese professor that had been mysteriously killed.
Let's finish with a media story. And now this is the big one that has been dominating the front pages this week. It's all about BuzzFeed acquiring HuffPost.
Yes, big shake-up of digital media brands. So the Wall Street Journal that broke the story called it a pact, which I thought was kind of an interesting term. So as I understand it, and I'm going to be honest, I'm still not sure I understand it, because it's a rather complicated pact. So Verizon, who previously owned HuffPost, they now get a minority stake in BuzzFeed. There's some unknown cash injection from Verizon to BuzzFeed. And the result of this deal is that the two companies can syndicate content. They can look for advertising deals together. And so this is going to be a good thing for both of them because they've both recently fired a lot of people. And so this way to kind of net new ad revenue and take money back from companies that unfortunately have lost money to Google and Facebook, this apparently is the solution, is to have this expanded staff and then matched ad revenue. If you understand more of this deal than I do, please go ahead, because I've just read four pieces about it and they haven't actually put out that much clear information about what this really means.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that this is something we'll be following over the next few weeks and all will become clear. Ruth, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
That was the journalist Ruth Michelson. You're listening to Monocle on Saturday. We'll be right back after this short break. Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin. This is Monocle on Saturday, and here is our editor, Andrew Tuck, with his weekly column.
It's early morning at Midori House, and I've managed to get in before anyone else for once. It's the first still moment for days. This week, the team sent Confect, a new quarterly title aimed mostly at our female constituents, to press. It was a whirlwind that brought back memories of making issue one of Monocle in 2007. A magazine launch needs determination, a willingness to let go of stories that have taken their toll on you, but have not quite made it past the finishing line. At least one standoff, some guts, and dinner in the office. But now it's all out of our hands, and the wait begins for a box of advance copies to return here from the printers in the coming days. That's another memory of Monocle's launch, the first box being ripped open, pages being flicked, paper caressed. We even had a photographer on hand to record the moment. God, we look young. But now I wonder, do I remember the moment, or does the photo make me? The Crown must be delivering epic audiences for Netflix, judging by the number of people discussing it. Even in an age of on-demand viewing, it's a show that creates that water cooler moment when people talk about a programme the next day at work to unpack its twists and revelations. The Monocle office is no exception, even if we don't have any water coolers. And while crusty royal commentators have been harumphing across the British press about the Crown's terrible inaccuracies, that's not the way Prince Charles would kiss his mother. He never had that medal. They only eat Battenberg cake on a Wednesday. Nothing they vent about has any impact. We are hooked by the glorious storytelling. And so, with each passing day, the Crown's edit of events re-engineers our memories. Its version of history is bedding in as the truth. I'd forgotten how badly the royal family treated Diana, said a friend the other day. That part where the Queen refuses to hug her is so awful. I pointed out that the scene was imagined, but she insisted, I'm sure that's exactly what would have happened. Memory, history, and fiction are all being stirred together with delicious effect, and it will be hard for viewers to ever recall how they used to feel about these events, these people, or even remember that this was not meant to be a history programme.
The headlines for you at 6 o'clock. Boris Johnson is self-isolating after meeting an MP who's tested positive for coronavirus.
The UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is languishing in self-isolation after spending time with an MP who subsequently was diagnosed with coronavirus. Mr. Johnson has clearly decided to use his lockdown time to undermine video conferencing and to make everyone yearn for a return to the office, to think about life at the water cooler again. In a series of genius appearances, he has at turns looked forlorn, like an old dog, and far away from the action. I don't know who his new advisers are, but they're doing wonders for the return to the office push that the nation will need next spring. I hear he might be doing the next Prime Minister's question sessions from bed in his pyjamas and wearing a wee willy winky nightcap. Go, Boris. Now that the temperature has dropped and the trees shimmered off their leaves, I decided it was time to refill the bird feeders and our small rooftop garden. Some 10 minutes after the grand reopening, I happened to glance out of the window, and there, waiting in the branches of the silver birch tree, was an excited flutter of various finches and tits jostling for their turn on the premium select nuts and seeds. How did word spread so fast? Have they had a feathered mate on watch all autumn anticipating this moment? I don't know for sure, but somehow a chirped out message along the lines of, "The plant-based restaurant that we used to frequent last winter has reopened and it's offering as much food as you can eat for free," had spread around the hood. I admit that's quite a detailed message for an old school tweet, but how else did they move so fast? Anyhow, I'm happy to see them back at Shade Tuck Nuts, and they will be well catered for in the weeks to come. Thanks for remembering us, guys.
Thank you very much to Andrew Tuck, and I do wish my local plant-based restaurant would reopen. Great sound effects there, courtesy of Steph Chungu. You're listening to Monocle 24. This is Monocle on Saturday. I'm Georgina Godwin. Now, the Booker Prize is the leading literary award in the English-speaking world. It's brought recognition, reward and readership to outstanding fiction for over 50 years. Awarded annually to the best novel of the year written in English and published in the UK or Ireland, it was awarded this Thursday to Douglas Stewart, the author of the debut novel, Shuggie Bain. Well, we're joined now by Samir Rahim, a 2020 Booker Prize judge and managing editor of Prospect magazine. Good morning to you, Samir.
Good morning.
Now, I understand that this was a unanimous decision. What was it about Douglas's novel that spoke to you?
Well, we were looking for something that really made a powerful impact, stretched what the possibilities of literature could be, something that moved us, something that maybe made us laugh, and something that really grabbed us as a literary work and also as a great story. And in fact, out of the 162 books, the novels that we read, this was for me the last one on my list. And it was amazing just to have this gift land in our laps. I started reading the first 10, 15, 20 pages, and gradually I realized that this was something really special. And what was great was that when we went to the meeting at the end of the that month, everyone else in the meeting had the same opinion as well, even from that early stage.
Mm. And I mean, that judging experience must have been a little odd because you were never all actually in the same room.
That's right. I mean, at the beginning, we did have a couple of in-person meetings, but because two of the judges are based in America, we always had someone on Zoom or whatever. And gradually, of course, we all went to virtual discussions. I don't know how it would have changed it, really. I suppose maybe we were slightly less likely to interrupt each other on Zoom. But we were also allowed little glimpses into each other's lives, and it became a more sort of intimate experience. And, of course, in this year of social distancing, having these books to read, I mean, that was really our social company for the whole year.
Mm. And I mean, I wonder, because the judges came from such different backgrounds. I mean, you have Margaret Busby, who, of course, is a kind of legend in the publishing industry. And then you have Lee Child, who's this mystery writer. And so you're all bringing different things to the table, really, aren't you?
Yeah, and that's the fascinating thing. I mean, everyone has their own expertise. Everyone has their own taste. Everyone has their own interest, but we were all looking for books that had that indescribable or indefinable quality that really, really gripped us. And we did disagree about lots of things. I think that's fair, and I think that's good. It would be strange if we all came to a consensus on every book. And I would say that the long list and the short list was a group decision. Some books that each one of us wanted on there didn't make it, but that's always going to be the case. Each person brought something slightly different and a different kind of perspective. Lemsy, say, is a poet. As you say, Margaret's a publisher. Emily is a classicist. I'm a novelist and a critic. So we all did bring different things. But in the end, when a book is as powerful as Douglas Stewart's is, then it wasn't that hard to unite behind it.
Mm. As you say, you're a novelist. Do you think that the judging experience will change the way that you personally write?
Well, one of the reasons I volunteered to judge the prize and accepted the offer is because I wanted to get a sort of satellite photograph of what people are doing in the English novel, just for personal reasons. You know, what kind of techniques are they using, or what are new boundaries that are being pushed, what old-fashioned techniques perhaps that are still in use. So for me, it's always interesting to see how people tell their stories, and picking apart a book that really works and trying to work out what it is about it that that makes it work is a fascinating experience. You can't just say, well, I like this or I didn't like this. People ask for reasons. And so you have to sort of test your critical faculties to say, well, actually, this works for this reason. So it was a great sort of intellectual and aesthetic investigation, as well as, you know, great company with the judges as well.
And so do you think you'll ever be able to read in a kind of I'm just switching off comfort reading sort of way again?
Well, I do. You know, my day job is as a literary editor, so I'm quite used to having to read books quite quickly and getting into them. I mean, I still, turning your passion and your love into your profession is always a slightly tough thing to do. But no, I think I did enjoy reading a lot of these books. I mean, the process of reading is that when you first go through them, it's about a book a day. So you are reading quite quickly. When you get to the long list and short list stage, you reread the books more slowly. So with The Winner, I read it three times, one pretty quickly in about in an evening, one over the course of a week, and then for the third time I took a month to read it, and I read it very slowly as I did the other shortlisted books, taking 20 or 30 pages a day and just trying to absorb it. And those three different readings allowed you to see the book from all different kinds of angles, and it becomes more apparent that the books which are susceptible to rereading, that may in 20, 30 or 40 years time still be read by people, that's the book you need to choose.
Mm. I wonder how influential the Booker is to a writer's career. And I mean, because for a debut novelist to win is really unusual.
It is. And we did have quite a lot of debuts on the long list, something we didn't actually quite realise until we decided it. It changes a writer's life. They can give up the day job. They can focus totally on their writing. It's something that they can always have, and even actually a shortlisting. For example, on other books that shortlisted is This Mournable Body by Tsitsi Dangaremna, Zimbabwean writer. And that book was a bit like Shuggie Bain, was, you know, a bit of a struggle to get published. I don't think she'll have any problems in the future. And I think that the attention that the prize brings can be a huge financial, reputational, and indeed just moral support to them.
Mm, absolutely, and in fact, in the case of Tsitsi, what it's also done is highlight the problems going on in Zimbabwe, which is a magnificent service for the people of Zimbabwe. Yesterday, the writer Jan Morris died. Now, she had an extraordinary life and career. And a little later on in the show, we're going to be looking back at her life and legacy. But I know that you worked with her for a bit, and I wondered if you could just share some personal memories.
Well, as I say, I never actually met her, but at the Sunday Telegraph, where I worked on the Telegraph books desk for a long time, she was the lead reviewer. And she was such a pleasure to deal with. She was always had a sort of little witty comment in an email, filed perfect copy, was always ready. And she was an extraordinary character with an amazing career. I mean, the funny thing is that when I started working with her, she was always just Jan Morris to me. And I think it was about a year in that I learned the backstory that, you know, she was James Morris many years ago. I think one of her most influential works is going to be the Empire trilogy that she wrote, which begins with Heaven's Command, this account of the Empire. And it's a rather incredibly entertaining, beautifully written, but quite old-fashioned view of the empire as a sort of derring-do exercise where Britain ruled the waves and wasn't it all quite glorious, really? And what's interesting is that attitudes towards the empire now are really reacting against that perhaps slightly old-fashioned view. But I think if anyone wants to understand Britain's relationship with the empire, what Britain's particularly elite classes still think and thought of it and still think of it, you should definitely read that trilogy. And it's a wonderful read as well.
Yeah. And of course, Jan Morris was actually shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Her novel Last Letters from Havre made the list in 1985. That was the 2020 Booker Prize judge, Samir Rahim. And do tune in tomorrow to meet the writers when I'll be speaking to the winner, Douglas Stewart. This is Monocle on Saturday. We'll be right back. Now, as we've just been hearing, Jan Morris, the travel writer and journalist who broke the news of Sir Edmund Hillary's summiting of Everest, has died at the age of 94. Well, commissioned for The Times, Morris travelled with Hillary and Tenzing Norgay in 1953 as far as base camp to witness the historic attempt to reach the peak. Morris wrote more than 50 books and was also a transgender pioneer and underwent gender confirmation surgery in 1972. Well, the journalist and broadcaster Robin Lustig joins us now to look back at her life and legacy. Robin, thanks for coming on. As we know, Jan was born James Morris in Somerset in 1926. Can you tell us a little of the life of this extraordinary person?
Yes, it is an extraordinary life. You're right. Even without her role as a transition pioneer, as James Morris, she started life as a soldier in the British Army. She then became a journalist, not only a journalist, but one of the country's most renowned journalists. I mean, as you say, her scoop on the ascent of Everest, her story appeared in The Times on the same day as the Queen's coronation. And James Morris, as she then was probably, if not the best-known journalist in Britain, certainly one of the best-known journalists. She then transitioned, as you said, in the 1970s and wrote an absolutely extraordinary book about it, Conundrum, which was, as far as I know, one of the first books, really, which set out what it meant to transition and what it meant to live as a trans person. And I remember reading it in the 1970s, shortly after it came out, and it made an enormous impression on me because this was something which at that time simply wasn't in the public domain. It wasn't discussed. She then became an absolutely stunning writer, as you say, a travel writer, although she didn't really like being known as a travel writer. She always said she wrote about places rather than about traveling to places. And the two books which made the deepest impression on me, one about Venice, which is still, I think, regarded as the classic book about one of the most fascinating cities in Europe. And then her last book in that genre, a book about Trieste, a city in northeastern Italy, which she called Trieste and the Meaning of Nowhere, which, quite apart from anything else, I think is a wonderful title. And it's a book suffused with melancholy. What always struck me about her writing about places was that she wrote about cities as if they were people, as if they were characters. She infused them with personality. And apart from anything else, she was the most glorious stylist.
Absolutely. Robin, what do you think her legacy will be?
Oh, her books. With two things. Her books and the fact that she lived her life with such, I was going to say grace, I'm not sure if that's the right word. I watched a documentary about her just a couple of years or so ago when she was already in her 90s. She lived with her lifelong friend, a woman whom she'd married when she was living as James Morris. She then divorced after she transitioned, but still lived with her to her the end of her life as her best friend and companion. They had, I think, a civil partnership towards the end. And she showed, I remember, she had a gravestone already inscribed for after her death, and it's a joint gravestone for the two of them, and it just says Jan Morris and Elizabeth Friends, which I think is the most glorious way of summing up a rather complicated life in the most simple way.
That's so lovely. Robin Lustig, thank you very much indeed, and RIP Jan Morris. And that's all we have time for on today's programme, which was produced by Carlotta Ribello, and our studio engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Georgina Godwin, and Monocle on Saturday will return at the same time next week. Do stay tuned to the station. We're with you for a few hours yet, but for the moment, thank you for listening.